Imagine a politician getting on stage today and saying, you know, my vision for a utopian future is like a highly contagious virus.
Yeah, or like a tech CEO getting up there and saying, hey, our brand new security software operates exactly like a catastrophic data breach.
Right. You'd think they had completely lost their minds. I mean, taking something that is notoriously invasive and, well, negative, and then making it the hero of the story, that is a massive rhetorical risk.
It really is. It's a huge gamble.
But thousands of years ago, a single sentence recorded in the historical texts of Matthew and Luke did exactly that. So today, welcome to our deep dive. We are taking a deep dive into a stack of historical commentaries, biblical scholarship, and ancient cultural research surrounding Jesus's parable of the yeast.
Yes, and our mission for you today is to show how this one, you know, microscopic story, which honestly sounds like a quaint Sunday school baking lesson, is actually designed to completely shock its original audience.
Totally, because on the surface, it sounds like a nice lady making bread.
It does. But it really is a masterclass in packing a dense amount of subversive meaning into, like, the smallest possible vessel.
Right.
Because if you look at the text, the parable is incredibly brief. It's literally just one sentence. It goes, "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into about 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough."
Which, again, sounds so domestic and simple, but as we've been going through these sources for you, I realize this is essentially a theological Russian nesting doll.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, like you twist that simple wooden shell apart and you find this layer of pure cultural shock value. And then you twist that apart and you find a hidden Old Testament reference.
Okay.
And you twist it one more time and suddenly you're staring at a radical geopolitical statement about how power actually operates.
Which is exactly why we need to start with that very first layer, you know, the shock value.
The yeast itself.
Right. To understand the mechanics of this parable, we really have to look at the psychology of a first century Jewish audience hearing the word yeast used as a metaphor for the kingdom of heaven.
Because today, I mean, yeast just means sourdough starters bubbling in a mason jar on a trendy bakery counter. It's artisanal.
Yeah, it's a good thing. But for the original audience, comparing heaven to yeast was a profound paradox.
A completely scandalous paradox.
Absolutely scandalous. To a first century Jewish listener, leaven, or yeast, was almost universally a symbol for sin, for corruption, and false doctrine. It was like the ultimate contaminant.
And I want to dig into why that is for listeners, because it's not just some random literary motif they came up with. It goes all the way back to their foundational cultural memory, right? The Exodus from Egypt.
Yes, exactly. So if you look at the festival of Passover, the Israelites were commanded to aggressively purge all leaven from their homes.
Like a massive spring cleaning.
A rigorous, almost paranoid sweeping of the house. They ate unleavened bread to remember how quickly they had to flee Egypt. You know, there was literally no time to let the dough rise.
Right, right.
But over the centuries, that act of throwing out the old leaven took on this deeply psychological symbolism. The old yeast represented the corruption of Egypt. It was the impurity, the idolatry, and really the oppression of their past.
So yeast is effectively branded as the oppressor's heir, in a way.
Yeah, that's a good way to frame it.
And that negative branding stays incredibly consistent, too. The sources point out that Jesus himself warned his disciples to, you know, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees, clearly using it as a metaphor for hypocrisy.
Right.
And then later, the Apostle Paul tells the Corinthian church that a little yeast leavens the whole batch. He's warning them that tolerating even a tiny amount of sin will just rot the entire community from the inside out.
Which brings us right back to the sheer shock of this parable. Jesus literally stands up and says, "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast."
It's crazy.
He takes this potent, historically ingrained symbol of impurity and completely reverses its polarity right in front of a crowd.
I do have to play devil's advocate here, though.
Okay, go for it.
Because I actually get where a minority of theologians are coming from on this. I was reading through the notes on scholars like A.W. Pink, and Pink looks at this universally negative track record for yeast, and he says, wait, we can't just flip the definition here.
Yeah, he takes a very different angle.
He argues this parable is actually a dark prophecy. He thinks it's a warning about corruption and false teaching creeping into the visible church and spoiling it. And honestly, I kind of get it. If you spend centuries telling your kids that yeast is the corruption of Egypt, isn't it a massive leap of logic to suddenly say it represents heaven? Like, how do modern scholars justify ignoring that context?
Well, it is a very fair question, and Pink's view definitely highlights the consistency of biblical metaphors.
Yeah.
We have to acknowledge that. However, the vast majority of historical and modern scholarship rejects that dark interpretation. And they do so by focusing on the mechanics of the metaphor rather than the moral alignment of the ingredient itself.
Okay, so how does that work?
Well, Jesus isn't saying the kingdom is corruption. He's using a really well-known rhetorical device, subverting a negative image to highlight an undeniable physical trait. He is demonstrating that, yes, sin has a pervasive, corrupting influence, but God's grace and truth have an equally pervasive, total unstoppable influence.
Oh, I see. It's like using a computer virus to describe a massive system update.
Exactly.
The delivery mechanism is invasive and inevitable, but the payload is a feature, not a bug. You know, the cure acts just like the disease.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. He strips all the moral baggage off the yeast to focus purely on its inevitable saturation. And once the audience gets over that initial shock, the narrative forces them to look at how this yeast actually operates.
Right, the action.
Yeah, the focus shifts from the ingredient itself to the woman's action.
And this is where the translation of the text hides something really fascinating. If you read a standard English Bible today, it just says the woman mixed the yeast into the flour. But our sources highlight that mixed is a pretty heavily sanitized translation, isn't it?
It really is. It smooths over the actual tension in the text. The literal Greek word used in both Matthew and Luke is enokrypsin, which translates to hid.
Hid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The woman didn't just mix the yeast, she hid it in the dough.
Which completely changes the vibe. I mean, mixing sounds like a daytime cooking show. Hiding sounds subversive. It sounds like espionage or something.
It absolutely does. And it points directly to the subterranean, invisible nature of the kingdom's work. Let's think about the physical reality of what happens when you fold yeast into a massive mound of flour.
It just disappears.
Exactly. It disappears. You cannot see the fungal spores. You cannot hear them working. And crucially, you can't extract them once they're introduced. Yet, on a microscopic level, that hidden agent fundamentally alters the chemistry of the host.
So it's not like adding chocolate chips to cookie dough where, you know, the chips just sit there and stay chips.
Right. They don't change the dough itself.
Yeah. This is more like introducing an acid to a base. It's a biochemical inevitability. It eats the sugars, releases gases, and completely reorganizes the structural DNA of the flour and water until the whole thing transforms.
Precisely. And we really have to place that biochemical reality into the minds of the people listening in the first century. You have to remember the geopolitical pressure cooker of Judea at the time.
Oh, for sure.
This was an audience living under the crushing militaristic occupation of the Roman Empire. The zealots, and honestly the general populace, were desperate for a Messiah. But their expectation was entirely external and violent.
They wanted a warrior.
Yes. They wanted a Bar Kokhba, a Maccabean warrior king who would ride in on a stallion, slaughter the Romans, and establish a visible, undeniable earthly throne.
They were waiting for this cinematic military invasion. And Jesus looks at an audience that is literally ready to take up swords and says, actually, the ultimate revolution is a quiet, microscopic process happening in the dark.
Right.
That must have been infuriating for the zealots in the crowd. I mean, it's basically an anti-conquest narrative.
It completely defies their expectations of how power operates. The kingdom of God, according to this hidden yeast, does not arrive with trumpets and legions. It infiltrates.
Wow.
It works quietly in the internal lives of individuals, altering the chemistry of human hearts and slowly working its way through the structures of society until a total transformation occurs from the inside out.
So the real power is in its invisibility.
Exactly.
But we can't stop there because the woman in the parable doesn't just hide this subversive yeast in a little bowl of flour. She hides it in a very specific amount of flour. Jesus gives us a recipe measurement, and it turns out, as we found in the sources, he wasn't just throwing out random numbers to set a domestic scene.
It's not at all. The measurement is where the deepest layer of this nesting doll resides. The Greek phrase used in the text is triasata, which translates to three siyas.
Okay.
And in ancient measurements, three siyas equals one ephah. If we convert that into modern terms for you, we are talking about roughly 50 to 60 pounds of fine flour.
Which is an utterly unhinged amount of flour for a home kitchen. I mean, you don't casually whip up 60 pounds of dough on a Tuesday afternoon.
You don't. That's an industrial operation.
You're producing enough bread to feed over 100 people easily. So just on a literal level, the sheer volume tells the audience that something deeply extraordinary is happening here.
But the volume is actually a hyper-specific literary callback. For a Jewish listener who is steeped in the Torah, hearing three seahs of flour would immediately light up a very specific memory for the book of Genesis, chapter 18 to be exact.
Okay, let's unpack Genesis 18 for everyone, because this is where the historical cross-referencing really blew my mind. This is the moment where Abraham is sitting by his tent at the Oaks of Mamre, and the Lord and two angels appear to him in human form.
Yes, three divine visitors arrive in the heat of the day. Abraham jumps up, runs to his tent, and tells his wife Sarah, quick, get three seahs of fine flour and knead it and bake some bread.
Three seahs of fine flour. It's the exact same phrase.
The exact same phrase. Jesus is taking this tiny parable about yeast and creating a direct hyperlink to one of the most pivotal moments in the life of Abraham and Sarah.
That is just incredible. By anchoring the parable to that specific narrative, Jesus is basically embedding three profound theological claims about the nature of his kingdom into the story, right?
He is.
Well, let's deduce what those are, starting with the scene itself. If God is physically showing up at Abraham's tent to share a massive meal, I mean, that totally shifts the tone of what the kingdom is supposed to be.
How so?
Well, it's not a sterile, fear-based religious ritual. It's a din party. It implies this incredible intimacy and divine fellowship.
That is the first major implication, yes. The kingdom is a magnificent welcoming feast where the divine communes directly with humanity. But the timing of that specific feast in Genesis 18 is what gives us our second implication. Why did God visit Abraham and Sarah on that particular day?
Oh, that's the chapter where God officially promises them a son, right? Isaac.
Yes.
Which is wild because Sarah is pushing 90 years old at that point. She literally laughs out loud at the absurdity of the idea.
She laughs because it is biologically impossible. It requires a miraculous divine intervention. So by tying the kingdom of heaven to the bread baked for that specific announcement, Jesus is making a claim about covenant promise.
Okay, unpacking that a bit.
The kingdom of God, much like the birth of Isaac, is born of a miraculous divine promise. It is not the result of human engineering, religious striving, or, as we mentioned earlier, military planning. God is the one who initiates it against all odds.
Wow, that completely takes the pressure off human achievement. It's a divine promise fulfilling itself.
Exactly.
And then there's the sheer scale of the bread. 60 pounds of flour for three guests. Even for ancient nomadic hospitality, that is ridiculous overkill.
It really is an economy of abundance, which brings us to the third implication, extravagant grace.
Mm.
The sheer volume implies that the kingdom provides an overflowing, inexhaustible supply of life. It's not a scarcity model.
Right.
God isn't rationing out just enough salvation to get by. It is lavish.
I love that image. You look at 60 pounds of dough and you just realize nobody is going hungry today.
Nobody.
But to fully grasp the weight of this, we need to zoom out a little bit. We've been looking at the yeast, the hiding, and the Abraham connection. But we have to look at how Matthew and Luke actually organized their books. This parable doesn't just sit isolated on a page.
No, the sequencing is critical here. In both gospel accounts, the parable of the yeast is placed immediately after the parable of the mustard seed. The sources emphasize that these are twin parables. They are specifically designed to be consumed together, illustrating the exact same concept from two contrasting angles.
So they're basically two sides of the same coin. The mustard seed is about a man who takes a tiny seed, plants it in a field, and it grows into this massive, towering tree where birds come to nest.
And if we contrast that with the yeast, we see this beautiful symmetry of opposites. First, just look at the domain.
Okay.
The mustard seed happens out in a field, the external visible world. The yeast happens inside a home, hidden in a bowl, the internal unseen realm.
And the protagonists are paired too, a man planting in a field and a woman baking in a kitchen. That basically ensures the metaphor encompasses the entirety of the human experience, both the agrarian economy and the domestic sphere.
That's a great point. But the most important contrast is the process itself. The mustard seed represents outward observable expansion. You can stand in a field and watch a tree grow over years.
Mm-hmm.
You can measure its height. You can see the birds landing in it. The yeast, however, represents inward, invisible transformation. As we establish, you cannot watch the enzymatic breakdown of dough. You can only witness the final result.
So if the mustard seed is the giant neon billboard that everyone can see miles down the highway, The yeast is the invisible algorithm running quietly behind the scenes, altering the code of the system.
Exactly.
You really do need both to understand the full picture of how this movement was designed to work.
Together, these twin parables offer a profound assurance to the listener. They acknowledge that the kingdom starts out looking incredibly unimpressive. A tiny seed, a microscopic fungus, or quite frankly, a carpenter from Nazareth with a dozen uneducated followers.
Yeah, not exactly a threatening empire at first glance.
Right, but they guarantee that its ultimate victory is certain. It operates on two frequencies simultaneously: outward expansion and total unavoidable internal saturation.
It's guaranteed to spread visibly, and it's guaranteed to transform invisibly, which is, I mean, it's just an incredible journey for one sentence of ancient text to take us on today.
It really is.
We started by unpacking the scandalous paradox of a first century crowd hearing their sacred kingdom compared to the corrupting leaven of Egypt. We debated the minority view, realizing that the shock value was the entire point.
And then we explored the subversive espionage of a woman hiding rather than mixing, defying every violent, militaristic expectation of the era.
We tripped over 60 pounds of flour, realizing Jesus was hyperlinking us straight into Abraham's tent to show us a kingdom built on divine fellowship, miraculous promises, and just an absolute overkill of extravagant grace.
And we finally saw how the invisible chemistry of the yeast perfectly balances the towering visible billboard of the mustard seed.
Right.
It reminds us that the most profound shifts in human history often happen in the quietest, most unobservable ways, long before the results are ever visible to the naked eye.
Which actually brings us to a final thought for you to mull over today. Our sources pointed out that once yeast is hidden and locked into the chemistry of the dough, it is impossible to extract it.
Yeah, it's completely integrated.
You can't unbake bread. You can't pull the yeast back out with a pair of tweezers. So, looking at the world around you today, if the kingdom of God acts like that subversive leaven, what are the invisible, unextractable ways it has permanently altered the chemistry of human history?
That is a great question.
Even in places or in cultures where the tree of the mustard seed can no longer visibly be seen, how has the dough of our world been forever changed by what was hidden inside of it centuries ago?
That is a fascinating lens through which to view history, art, and just the foundational shifts in human society in general.
It really makes you think. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this encourages you to look a little closer at the sources you read, because sometimes that quaint, simple story on the surface is just the first shell of a massive, beautifully complex nesting doll waiting for you to twist it open. Keep digging, and we will catch you next time.